I'm so grateful to have an opportunity to learn more about Duarte Zola. I feel like I have, in some ways, found a fellow traveler and certainly a luminous mind with theological sensibilities that I appreciate, who I want to journey with in the years ahead. And my in the years that I lived in Berlin, I would occasionally ask one of the sort of older German church women or church men who had been affiliated in some way with the church resistance, who they thought in the post-war kind of theological scene best exemplified Bonhoeffer's vocation and, you know, was attending to many unfinished matters, especially in this late thought. And time and again, I would hear the name Duarte Zola. And, I would not immediately hear Jürgen Moltmann or Eberhard Jungel or Friedrich Dogarten, who Zola mentions, or Pannenberg, or any of the other luminaries, Michael Toynison, but Duarte Zola. And I think it hopefully will be, if it's not already, obvious to you why she belongs in this sort of canon of, shall we say, non-academic theological writers and thinkers who constitute the cast of characters in religion 5009. Reinhold Niebuhr, you probably know, did not have a doctorate. He barely managed to get admitted to Yale Divinity School and finished with the Bachelor of Divinity, or what's often called the Master of Divinity, now the MDiv. Bonhoeffer had two doctorates, but did not pursue a theological vocation within the kind of confines, as he understood them, or within the structures of the German Academic Guild, though he certainly could have, but sought to live into a new kind of theological vocation. And it was a struggle, and there were, you know, failures and different efforts to incarnate that and to live it. Martin Luther King Jr., of course, arrived in Montgomery in 1954 as a brilliant doctoral student at Boston University, but still ABD, you know, all but dissertation, as they say, and finished his doctoral dissertation sometime during that busy first year as senior pastor at Dexter, but pursued, instead of an academic track, a theological vocation, first of all, in service to a particular congregation, and then as a kind of you know, minister, pastor at large, to this civil rights ministry that emerged in the formation of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, and coincided with King's move from Montgomery to Atlanta. Well, you know from reading her fascinating memoir, Against the Wind, Duarte Zola found herself in a situation that is not, at least when I was a grad student, not completely unfamiliar. And it was having a committee of readers reject her initial manuscript and defense. Eventually, her dissertation, her doctoral dissertation, was accepted, and she would become known kind of colloquially as Professor Dr. Dorothea Zola. But, you know, she never was granted a position within the German academic world as a professor, as a what we would call in the U.S. a tenure track or a tenured professor. Though she did have 11 years, I think maybe 12, as a guest professor and lecturer at Union Theological Seminary in New York. The biographer, I think there are two or three kind of biographical treatments of Zola. The best is by a woman named Renata Vind, I guess. And it's a short book called Dorothea Zola, Mystic and Rebel, the Biography, that's now available in English translation with Fort Church University Press, introduces the theologian and political activist, poet, thinker, mystic, fearless first wave feminist, Dorothea Zola, as one who took seriously Karl Barth's familiar demand that good theological, sound theological thought begins every morning with the Bible on one side of the desk and the morning newspaper on the other. And of course, if you know Barth, it also included a recording of Mozart. He listened to Mozart every day, and above his desk, a portrait of John Calvin. Barth's point was that the Bible is read in a particular political and social context, and it's read against that particular social context in view of its basic convictions of the God who reveals God's self and comes to humanity from the far country of the triune being in Israel and in Jesus Christ and in Scripture. The Bible taught Dorothea Zola to speak with God in a time when, as you know from her memoir, she had grown justifiably disillusioned with the church and with the possibility of the Christian movement to speak a concrete redemptive word into the social order. The news confronted her with the world as a place that is still, and if not forever, determined by violence, where talking about God must prove itself worthy in the face of the history of violence. And I appreciate the fact that Zola, in her various analyses of our interconnected, ever exquisitely interwoven global reality, is animated in all of its forms of discrimination and injustice and cruelty and the like by the spirit of violence and by the forces of violence. Her theology has been characterized as radical as political, as feminist, as mystical, as post-theistic, as post-metaphysical. It might also be called post-religious, in the sense in which Bonhoeffer, you recall, cast religion as, quote, the time when people can be told everything by means of words alone, where the theological pious, this 1900-year-old preoccupation with the idea of a religious a priori, this idea that there is something that is innately, inherently religious in human being, and it is part of this kind of evolutionary energy towards perpetual peace. And indeed, Zola's theology can be described as post-metaphysical. If you recall for a minute the intense conversations in the 1980s, early 90s, clustering around postmodernism and theology, and particularly the work of the deconstructionist theologians who both those working in a kind of Nietzschean vein and those working in a kind of Barthian vein wanted to rethink Christian faith and practice on the basis of non-metaphysical foundations, on foundations that did not require an epistemology, an epistemological kind of clarification, did not require an apologetics of sorts, but was governed by the peculiar logic and inner relations of particular discourses. The great biblical scholar Walter Brueggemann summed up Dorothea Zola's project well, I think, when he described her as a tough Christian, a rare presence in world Christianity, because she embodies the best of classical theology, a clear grasp of our broad social crisis, and a lyrical quality of expression and determination to keep faith linked to political reality. What may not come through in translations of Zola's work is, I think, at times that lyrical quality of expression. Her doctoral degree was actually in Germanistic and German literature, and it was broadly, covering issues related to the relationship between theology and literature. And sometimes I wonder when I actually look at the way, this book just fell apart. The English translations are both the way. And some of the actual translated text, but also the way they have been produced and their appearance as text on the page, the letting, if you will, which publishers call, the kind of space between sentences, the layout, all of this, and I'm looking at the chapter we read, today, as if we lived in a liberated world. And there's so many times when I just wanted the flow of prose to be broken so that there was more attention given in the design of the page to the word and the phrase and the thought. I even, the term a dingbat is an editorial term for a little symbol that breaks up a text into, you know, smaller units of text. And you'll see those, you know, certainly in literary memoirs and the like. There's an aphoristic quality, I think, in Zula's writing. You know, she published four books of poetry and always wanted to kind of exemplify in all of her writings what she called a theopoetics, which is a way of kind of rethinking the style in which theology is written. And I feel that that aspiration is obscured in just the way the printed page comes to us. The words come really hard off the page, and there's very little room for pausing and taking note of what has been read. One of the literary purposes of these dingbats and it's a strange term, is, you know, if you think of a memoir like my daughter and I read a memoir about called Bluets, suddenly forgetting the name of the author. You probably know her if you do tell me. There's a kind of new convention of literary writing in which, you know, chapters are shorter, sections are shorter. And obviously that in some way mirrors our diminished attention span. But I also think that it mirrors, you know, the flow of sort of our natural thinking. You look at scripture, for example, it's broken down into chapters and verses. And though most Bibles are printed in like microfiche size print, the purpose of that from a literary perspective was to encourage a certain kind of pace and even languor with the word. In any case, when you just Google her name, you'll see her described in her obituaries and in, you know, popular and scholarly magazines almost without exception, you know, as a radical thinker. And I think it bears some some attention to kind of linger over that word for a minute, because radical as an adjective meant to describe a certain form of religiosity, you know, has become in recent decades objectionable or problematic, you know, as the kids say. What Zola means by, and what is meant in most cases when the adjective radical is, the term radical is ascribed to Zola, is not so much a sense of kind of emotional fervor or kind of dogmatic zeal. It's certainly not meant to insinuate any kind of violent crusading, radical in the sense of wanting to mute and quash dissenting voices. But it stands, but the term radical Christianity does represent an important, perhaps often forgotten tradition which within the Christian faith. And I would simply note a very helpful anthology that was put together by Christopher Rowland, who teaches at Queens College, Oxford, and a pastor named, who I don't know, named Andrew Bradstock, who works for the United Reformed Church in London, called Radical Christian Writings, A Reader. And it includes many of the sort of exemplars that we find throughout the silent cry, though it wants to kind of construct a tradition of this radical Christian discourse, from the second century through William Stringfellow, Carter Haywood, Oscar Romero, Sarah Maitland, Kenneth Leach, Gustavo Gutierrez, and a great theologian named Tom Hanks. Honestly, his name is Thomas Hanks. I don't know who he is, but I don't think it's the person that we so admire. This also includes King. It's a really helpful volume. And I wanted to read you a short passage from this volume. I think I made copies of these two pages. If I did, let me send those to you now. So I want us to think of this particular tradition and of Zola, and to be sure, King and Bonhoeffer and Niebuhr as well, as exemplifications of this tradition that that kind of reads as an alternative or counter narrative to perhaps the story of Christianity that has been largely the sort of story of dogmatic and doctrinal debates and the emergence of Christian orthodoxy. The gospel of Jesus Christ, announcing the arrival of the kingdom or reign of God, offered a radical and subversive challenge to the world, its powers, and authorities. Throughout Christian history, and particularly at times of crisis and social upheaval, there have emerged writings which, reflecting the values of the kingdom of God, have engaged in searching critiques of the political order and promoted change in social and economic relations, most commonly by advocating or enacting equality of wealth, gender, power, or status. This collection brings together in one volume such writers from various periods of Christian history, et cetera, et cetera. There is an appeal within this tradition to the roots, to Jesus and the early church's paradigms of what Christian polity and action should be about. Frequently, this tradition, this radical tradition, expresses itself as a critique of false religion, which places institutions and rituals above the needs of people. This theme runs through the earliest texts through to the most recent in this collection. And then if we can move down to the middle of that page, what one finds in this tradition is not merely abstract reflection, therefore, but exposition of understandings which are based on an active engagement to see another kind of order at work in the world, the realization of God's kingdom on earth. What impressed us was that again and again, similar themes and convictions emerge, suggesting to us that there was some kind of radical tradition. And yet the word tradition hardly adequately describes what is going on here. Even if historically connections can be made between the various writings represented in this book, that sense of destiny and vocation, which characterized so many of those who wrote them, often meant that there was little awareness on their part of indebtedness to others. And we could continue with that very excellent introduction, but I offer that as a way to locate Zola within what has been so helpfully developed by Bradstock and Rowland as this tradition of radical Christianity. Zola offers what I find the most illuminating account of her own theological self-understanding In the final chapter of Against the Wind, the memoir we read for today, and if you'll turn in Against the Wind to the last chapter, and I know many of you have this on a digital form and not on not in the beautiful little edition that Fortress made available. Turn to page 166. If the question at stake right now is how do we understand Zola as a theologian, not only mapping her into the story of modern theology, but within the Christian tradition, how does she understand herself as a theologian writing, you know, out of the ruins of a nation that had considered itself the apotheosis of Christian civilization, and coming of age as a thinker, an intellectual, a writer, and a theologian, literally in this time after the Holocaust. She writes at the top of page 166, as I understand it, what is the origin of theology? That's a weird sentence. I believe that it really does take its rise in a stable that reeks of historic injustice. And she means a literal stable. She means what Bonhoeffer meant when in a prison letter, he noted that we ought never forget that Christian faith in practice begins and ends, departs and returns to the story of the God who was born homeless in a manger, the child of immigrants in this scene of marginality that is not only a kind of that is not to be understood as historical accident, it's understood as a kind of a theological attribute of the God professed and worshipped. And there we are with our far too small spades talking to one another. Theology that is truly alive never arises outside of and apart from its situation. It does not drop straight from heaven as God's word. Rather, it constitutes itself in the solidarity of those affected. Bonhoeffer's phrase that you find in this letter that goes by the title After 10 Years, written on New Year's Eve, 1942, shortly before his arrest, in the final section, speaks of ways in which Christianity may have a future. Evil has run roughshod over over the virtues of humanity, decency, toleration, respect, as Bonhoeffer enumerates in that essay. And he speaks of a view from below. Are we still of any use? If we are, we must engage the world as men and women who are chastened by history, chastened by Christianity's complicity in brutalities against humanity, chastened by the church's lack of civil courage and honesty and the like. And he proposes a view from below, a reorientation of theology as a way of speaking without certitude, without kind of dogmatic claims. It's not to suggest that there aren't dogmatic confessions and there aren't ways in which the language of orthodoxy even is intended to configure this new language, but it's a language that has a new tone and a new kind of voice, a new style, and it speaks of the Christian witness not as one that enters the scene, you know, with all the answers to all the problems having already been worked out, to recall that quote by Merton that was circulated several weeks ago, but as men and women who stand alongside others who may come to the work of mercy and justice from other convictions and with other banners waving in the wind, participating in this one common redemptive purpose. So in any case, we find this reorientation on the very meaning of the theological vocation in Zola. And I think what we find as well in The Silent Cry is, that I'll get to presently, is Zola not only offering us a profoundly compelling corrective of theology's overdetermination in dogmatic certitudes, but a kind of cloud of witnesses of men and women who are part of this collective, if you will, canon of dissident voices, if you will. So if we think again of Zola's coming of age in this nation that considered itself the apotheosis of Western civilization, born in 1929, she was part of the first generation of doctoral students after the war. I want us to just take note of that context one more time. Here we find a nation that had long gravitated to its martial aspirations, and as we know from our own ways of thinking about American exceptionalism, a kind of nationalism that the 19th century philosopher Gottlieb Fichte had given voice to in his lumbering addresses to the German nation, that the German spirit, the German essence, has this kind of providential blessing. And to quote Fichte from that address, this providential blessing, this German spirit, will open up new shafts and bring the light of day into their abysses and hurl up rocky masses of thoughts out of which ages to come will build their dwellings. I mean, Fichte, like most of his contemporaries in the 19th century, believed that an organic, if not metaphysical, relation existed between the God of the Bible and the essence of German Christian identity. Church leaders, theologians, pastors played a vital role in promoting the ideas of the folk and the people and fatherland in a unifying spiritual vision, which gave birth, of course, to this kind of world marauding German ethnocentrism, ethno-nationalism. You note from our reading several weeks ago that many German theologians promoted this disinheritance theory, boasting that Christianity canceled God's election of the Jews and thus abolished their inheritance of the covenant. And this theological boast cleared the way for the German nation's pursuit of creating a world without Jews. Indeed, many argued that Jesus should himself no longer be regarded as a Jew, or that the New Testament should be wholly deracinated from the Hebrew Bible. And the hope here was that once Christianity had been stripped of its Jewishness, it would be an easy step to think of Jesus, you know, as a blue-eyed, blonde-haired German male, and of the German nation as God's favored nation. There's a wonderful, obscure, forgotten little book. It's a gem of a book by a Canadian scholar named Alan Davies called Infected Christianity, A Study of Modern Racism. I highly recommend that book. And if you need to borrow a copy of that book, we have a couple of copies that Guy can help you check out in our Live Theology library in my library in the basement of Gibson Hall. It's published by McGill University Press, and I think it's very hard to find. But it's what's so interesting about it, it's organized around five, what he calls five racist Christologies. And these are Christologies that are located in historical settings. So there's an analysis of the Afrikaner Christ, of the Jim Crow Christ, of the Anglo Saxon Christ, of the Germanic Christ. In any case, and there's a fifth, I can't quite remember, the fifth Christ. Davies explained in this remarkable little book that more and more the Aryan Christ became a synonym for the essential divinity of Aryan man, clothed in Aryan dress and elevated to the status of white German tribal deity. Jesus became the perfect religious symbol of a racist church in a totalitarian state. There were precious few voices of dissent among the ranks of the pious and the church and the churchling. By the mid-1930s, and honestly, this would have been around the time that Zola was confirmed as a Lutheran. I don't know that she mentions anything about her confirmation in the memoir. Baptisms, in any case, in the German churches, routinely concluded with the prayer, quote, that this child, this young man, this young woman, this boy, this girl will, quote, grow up. This was written into the catechism or into the liturgy to be like Adolf Hitler and Heinrich Himmler. The theology departments now existed for the sole purpose of building a religious foundation for this new state ethics. There had been no room, little room, in the tradition of German martial theology for a theology of resistance and theology of dissent. And to the extent to which we have like the fragments of that, you know, in Bonhoeffer's letters and papers from prison, I think we can call the silent cry, resistance and mysticism, our most fully kind of realized account of a Christian theology of resistance. And this context indeed prompts Zola's entire theological project and around such questions as, you know, how might Christians or anyone in the Anglo-European kind of context develop the skills and discernments and the interpretive capacities that will enable us to see the idols, to see the Antichrist, to wage resistance against the false gods, against, you know, a Nazified church, against demands for total state loyalty. The Christians in this time after have the theological tools to name and then to resist the false gods. I'd like to now, in just the last 10 minutes of our time together, point us to what I hope will be a helpful kind of enumeration of the major themes in Zola's work and in this book that constitute the pillars of that remarkable project. I'm skipping briefly over some biographical notes, but you just read her memoir. Alas, you have most of that already in your notes. And I would like to just have us sort of consider now sort of the major themes of the major kinds of building blocks in her post-theistic, post-Holocaust project of speaking Christianly without recourse to the old certitudes that have often been the kind of guarantors of Christian conviction. The first is, that she develops this theology of resistance. Okay, and the major themes would include, just to sort of give those to you at the outset, a theology of existence, a theological understanding, an affirmation of the death of God, a kind of theological poetics of liberation, an exemplification of a new way of writing theology. And I think she's very attentive to questions about style, like, has that period when Christian faith and practice can be cataloged in these great architectonics of systems and systematic accounts become untenable, if not immoral, in the wake of the Holocaust. In any case, she's attentive to questions that Bonhoeffer raises, indeed, in Letters and Papers from Prison, is, perhaps theology needs to be written in ways that that mirror the fragmentary nature of Christian belief, that mirror the chastening of history, that mirror the kinds of impressionistic accounts of being Christian that seems to be more fitting, if not humble, in their conclusions. And then I would like to say that, and I hope these are helpful points for your conversation, I think there's also an investment or a stake in offering us a theology of seeing, of perception, of way of imagining, a vision. I mean, we have throughout the writings of Bonhoeffer and King, but we didn't attend to this so carefully at the time. There are numerous images of sight, of perception, of light, of vision, I mean, I see the promised land, and you can think of the ways in which, you know, the imagery of dreams and the imagery of seeing that kind of insinuate a new kind of perception of the world. I think all of this is also part of Zola's project. But let's just begin with a theology of resistance, a theology of dissent, a theological vocabulary of resistance. Zola tells us in the introduction to her book that as a citizen of a wealthy industrialized country, resistance had in recent years become more and more an important part of an expression of political culture. And you would know that in 2016 in this country, the term resistance and the idea of resistance suddenly, you know, gained great currency, particularly in the discourse of the left and those who stood in opposition to the rise of Trumpism. And Zola would say that it is as if in this word, resistance, I could express best what common life really means, even though I know very well that most often for people who are just learning to walk, it is like a shoe that is too big. For Zola, the word resistance contains the memory of European resistance against Nazism, fascism, Stalinism, as well as other human rights violations in the sphere where power was expressed by the socialist regime. It also contains the memory of the dead, and she mentions movingly both Sophie Scholl, whose papers Zola would edit in this lovely volume, this heartbreakingly beautiful volume called The White Rose, as well as Bonhoeffer. And I was thrilled to see, though I don't think you read it in the chapter for today, that Martin Luther King's vision of Jesus in the Montgomery kitchen in 1956 becomes a part of this kind of theological imagination that cleaves to Christ and forming a coherent coherent view of resistance against the principalities and powers. Resistance, you know, she notes, it was a battle cry that persecuted Huguenots scratched on the wall and the towers of Avis Mortes. I do not want to be separated from them and the many others all over the world who in seemingly hopeless situations waged a defiant no against the surrounding powers of death. What I can do, she says, in the context of the rich industrialized world I inhabit, is going to be minute and fragmentary and piecemeal. And it's also perhaps going to be without risk, you know, there's certainly the same risk in comparison with many of these martyrs of resistance the pages of The Silent Cry. The issue, she says, is not to venerate heroes, and it's not to create this sort of gallery of larger than life saints, but to call on this, you know, cloud of witnesses to help assemble, you know, a theological vocabulary of resistance, actively and deliberately calling on them in the very diverse situations that we find ourselves in, you know, in 2021, but that share with all forms of resistance in waging protest against the habituated powers of death and against these dehumanizing forces that inhibit and quash human flourishing. Some of you may have read Albert, the novelist and writer, philosopher Albert Camus, a remarkable essay. It was from an address that he gave in 1948 to, I think it was a Dominican monastery in France, who had invited him as a kind of Christ-haunted ex-Catholic. I mean, if you can be ex-Catholic, I'm not sure you can, but nonetheless, a Christ-haunted agnostic, sometimes atheist, he would call himself, to explain to this group of Dominican priests why he rejected Christianity. And I find this to be altogether compatible with Zola's project. In this address, Camus acknowledges that he shares with these Dominicans the same revulsion from evil, and that they that there are common, you know, goals of human flourishing and diminishing cruelty and brutality that they share. But he said, "I do not share your hope, although I continue to struggle against this universe in which children suffer and die." And he says, he explains to them why he does not share this hope. And in this passage that I find endlessly haunting, Camus explains, "What the world expects of Christians is that Christians should speak out loud and clear, and that they should voice their condemnation in such a way that never a doubt, never the slightest doubt, could rise in the heart of the simplest person. That they should get away from abstraction and confront the bloodstained face history has taken on today. The grouping we need is a grouping of people resolved to speak out clearly and to pay up personally. When a Spanish bishop blesses political executions," Camus writes, "he ceases to be a bishop or a Christian or even a man. He is a dog, just like the one who, backed by an ideology, orders that execution without doing the dirty work himself." And then Camus says, "We are waiting, we are still waiting, and I am waiting. The unbeliever is waiting for a grouping of all those who refuse to be dogs and who are resolved to pay the price that must be paid so that humankind can become something more than a dog." Well, Zola wishes to craft a theological language of such Christian conviction and of such hope, as well as to show that such groupings as those Camus is looking for have indeed been part of the Christian story, since one of its earliest observers noted, and I speak of the early Christian document that some of you may know, St. Matthias' Epistle to Dionysius, drafted in the early second century and written in the fashion of one of St. Paul's letters. It's a remarkable document that was most likely written, you know, as a kind of catechism of sorts. And in this ancient document, we find the question raised, who are the Christians? What God do they trust? By what standard do they live their lives? And then St. Matthias himself responding, what is the affection which they cherish? The Christians do not live as pagans. They do not worship God through superstition or through the spilling of animal blood and the smoke of sacrifices and burnt offerings. The Christians do not worship gods made by hand. Neither are they distinguished by the country in which they live or the customs they keep. Rather, the Christians inhabiting foreign cities, remaining fully in the places of their birth, display a wonderful and confessedly striking method of life. They are marked by a distinctive manner of style," and he goes on to enumerate those peculiar practices of forgiveness and reconciliation. And reading Silent Cry, mysticism and resistance is, I think, the fullest way in which Zola offers us an account of a response to Camus' question. I am looking for, I am waiting for a grouping of men and women who will first and foremost recognize that the way of Jesus leads to the way of shared struggle for the flourishing of the world and against its brutalities and against the powers of death that surround us. I am, alas, nearly out of time. I would just like to say one final thing. And I can make this one final point in 5 or 6 minutes, but can we just take a quick break right now and come back for that 5 or 6 minutes? Because I think this may help launch us into the second period. Okay, I'll be right back. I think the question that has been it's been kind of in my mind recently in relation to some of the work I've been doing of what comes after is one that's particularly alive in Zola's project. What comes after, the movement? And, when we look at the story of the civil rights movement, the resistance movement, other movements, they run their course. What comes after? What comes after the great profanation, the great masquerade of evil, the observation of Western Christendom in ruins, what comes after is I think the question that kind of animates the way Zola thinks about the task of theology and even the future and possibility of Christianity. This is not doing, theology as if nothing else were happening, but it's doing theology with this sense of having been chastened by history with a view from below that Jesuit theologians and Zola herself, as a Protestant, name as a preferential option for the poor. And although most churches failed to resist Hitler, Zola, after the war, increasingly saw Christianity as, in fact, offering a critical resources and language and categories and logic, if you will, for movements of social justice with the potential to oppose fascism, totalitarianism, social oppression. And as a sort of a first world liberation theologian, she is indeed the successor of Bonhoeffer's late ruminations on the church for others. What happens after the war, as the ruins of the German Christian church are everywhere evident? What happens after the shattering of the dream, after the Holocaust? Christians will need new ways of speaking God, of thinking about God. And if we follow Zola's path of thought, we are inclined to think that being a Christian after the Holocaust means living in a new kind of church. The institutional church for her was always a place of largely concerned about its own institutional survival. She would have agreed with Bonhoeffer's proposal in outline for a book that this church for others must be a church that, if it exists at all, is forever giving itself away, ever going out of existence, a church for others, if you will. And with this emphasis comes a defense of the future and possibility of Christianity after the Holocaust. But she is importantly wanting to marshal, you know, the resources of the Christian tradition to make the case that the disciplines of resistance and reconciliation are best fortified with theological, spiritual, mystical, erotic, theopoetic energies, images, and language. And I leave you with this quote. I'll have to find the source of it. It's some. It's, I think, from her first book on the death of God. It is an illusion to assume that we live in a scientifically transparent and controllable world that can do without belief in the God of justice. It is, after all, only the rich who can comfortably do without God. And I will ask Guy that perhaps at some point in your conversation today, y'all can look at those three pages that I sent you from her great early academic treatise called Christ the Representative, an Essay in the Theology After the Death of God, in which she both gives an account of her understanding of the death of God and why it's important for the Christian to affirm the death of God in its most vivid and fully realized forms. And for her, this would be in Nietzsche's writings. And at the same time, to acknowledge that, as I'll read, theology informs us that only the one who has learned who Christ is knows and can say who, I'm going to just use the patriarchal language in the translation, himself is. This assertion, summing up the theme of my work, is tendentious, of course, biased in favor of the kingdom of God in which personal identity is said to be possible. No further demonstration of man's longing for identity is often offered here. It is regarded as axiomatic. Whether there have ever been or ever will be human lives not engaged in the search for personal identity cannot be demonstrated empirically and historically, nor does this lessen the gravity of the question for ourselves. Again, while we cannot demonstrate that it's the experience of Christ which enables us to achieve identity, we can certainly reflect upon this claim. Theology will then be a reflective description of certain experiences. And so she wants to, in this fashion, retain the language of certainly, I wouldn't say in her case, Christian orthodoxy, but the language of a Christocentric or a Christomorphic accounting of reality as, you know, the animating kind of language for the practices of resistance and the pursuit of beauty that sort of configures her project.